and to be able to share together in this time. I hope you all had a good Thanksgiving. We had different gatherings, and Dorothy and I enjoyed some good time with not only our children, but also our daughter-in-law Liz's family from Kansas, and her brother from her parents from Kansas, and her brother from New York State, and his family came. So their house was quite full, and we had a good time, and we're grateful for such a loving family. The office was closed all week, and so there's a minor communication thing. The title that I had given was "Growth Comes in the Cracks," and this isn't really a disclaimer, but John, as we were walking in, he raised some questions about the passages and their content, so I'm publicly stating that this year we're, as we did last year, we're following this Leader Magazine, which is a publication of Mennonite Media, and it's for both the Canadian Church and the Church in the U.S., MCUSA, and this year there's a Canadian committee that led the process of choosing all of the passages and so forth. And so when I read this, I was kind of when I read the passages, when I was looking through the material, they basically put things together as life is a journey, life is a pilgrimage, and so forth. And these stories, they were pulling out things related to a pilgrimage, and so the display ties in with steps along the way in this journey and this pilgrimage. And we didn't fully abandon their approach, but we didn't fully embrace it. And so I'm interested in seeing how this all comes together. But this passage, these two passages, I simply did not get. And I have to acknowledge that it's because in my mental space, I've had very little room for Daniel as a book. As a form of literature, I've had issues. As a form in terms of just understanding its content, I've had struggles with it. And so I've basically ignored it, but it's not really the content so much as how people use the content that has been problematic for me. And so there are, all kinds of visions throughout the book. And that's the way those visions have been used has been what I've struggled with. But reading this now and reading this in this particular context, it's been actually very helpful. But it wasn't really until fairly late last night that suddenly the two bits in my brain clinked into place. So anyway, I'm grateful for Dorothy's pressing questions and not accepting certain of my statements. And so it's out of that tension that the conversation continues. So anyway, as we look at, if we look at the entire book of Daniel, over and over again, there are tensions between the king or the national leader and Daniel or these Hebrew the group of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and Daniel, they're in a place of tension. And so that's where this title, Between a Rock and a Hard Place, because it's all these young Hebrew people. But how did they get there? How did they get to Babylon? Does anybody know right off how they came to be there? Yes, but more than just exiled. Exiled from where? Okay. And okay, that's what I'm talking about. Taken hostage. So they didn't voluntarily, some voluntarily left and just fled wherever they fled to. Others, though, were essentially taken as slaves. They were taken captive. And if you read at the beginning there, it says that in particular, they wanted young men without physical defect and handsome, versed in every branch of wisdom, endowed with knowledge and insight, and competent to serve in the king's palace. They were to be taught the literature and language of the Chaldeans. The king assigned them daily portions and royal rations for them every day, food and wine. They were to be educated for 3 years so that at the end of that period, they could be stationed in the king's court. So you've got this king who's got an expansionist program and has gone all the way from the home area in Babylon to Jerusalem, has sacked Jerusalem and taken captives. But he didn't just order it in a random way. The captives were to be taken, and particularly a particular triage was to take place. You know, it was like unblemished. You know, my body's blemished as can be. You know, I mean, seriously, how many people could fit this criterion that he had? You know, a level of education, a level of physical attractiveness, a level of skin perfection. Give me a break. It's very few people could meet this criterion, right? And anyway, so he takes these guys, and in particular, there are the four, and they, in the story here, it goes back and forth because the king has different, scholarship says that there was more than one Daniel and that these stories are from different periods of time and they were pulled together. So I decided not to spend time on the critique side, rather to look just at this story in relation to the other stories, yes, but not to evaluate that timeline or try to set it into a broader historical context. But in each of the cases, each of the different stories, there are some massive similarities. And in these stories, we have the leader, the king Nebuchadnezzar or Darius or others, who are in their position of power, and they have a dilemma. Something occurs. So there's the status quo, which is defined in relation to Daniel and the others, and the relationship between the king and them, and these are four respected young men, Daniel being the one who is seen as particularly gifted. And they are young Hebrew Jewish people who are in the Babylonian hierarchy. At one point, it's described as Darius putting in, you know, some 100 satraps to rule in local areas, local government authorities, as it were. And then you've got each of them reporting to three provincial leaders. Excuse me, I've had a thick throat That doesn't help. Sorry, but I just drank some and now that seems to have helped here, even though it shocked the airwaves. By the way, if there are there people on Zoom? Can they all were they're in shock from the cough. Sorry about that. Well, welcome those of you who are on Zoom. It's nice to have you here. But in the story, there are multiple situations where the king has a vision or a dream or something that happens, and lo and behold, it's only these Hebrews that can interpret it. So in the first case, the dream, there's this grandiose dream, and what the king says is he calls upon, what are they called? He calls upon all of his magicians and so forth to come and give an interpretation of the dream. And what he says, though, is that he's not going to tell them what the dream is. You're going to have to tell me what I dream and give the interpretation. And all of his, like I think of the, in medieval days, there were court jesters and so forth. Well, there are all these people around the king who are to manipulate his mood and make him feel happy and that he's great and all of this different stuff. And it was the same thing in these more ancient times. So he's got all these people surrounding him who come and tell stories. And they're magicians, they do magic, they do different things. And what happens here? None of them can respond. In fact, they say, how could anybody know what dream you had? That's simply impossible. And then somebody says, oh, but there's this Daniel, he's really pretty insightful or whatever. And so he's brought there, and the king says, tells him what. To what the conditions are. Tell me what my dream is and give the interpretation. And what does Daniel do? He says, that's an impossible demand. But I worship the true God. And because I worship the true God, God will share me with me what the dream is and the interpretation. And lo and behold, that's what happens. And what's Nebuchadnezzar's response in the first situation? He praises God. He comes to not faith in God, the God of Israel, but he changes his perspective on his own sovereignty and recognizes there's a sovereign above this political leader. The same thing happens a little bit later, and this time it's the Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and they are praying to God, the God of Israel, and they're doing it, and these satraps and other leaders are jealous of them, and so they set up making a law to keep them from doing this worship of God, any other God than the king. And lo and behold, they're caught, they're told. They report to the king that this is going on. And so what happens? Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, we saw it on the song. What were they doing? Where were they thrown? Into the furnace. And the furnace was so hot. How hot was the furnace, Jackie? So hot. It was so hot. It was hotter than Newport News this summer. It was so hot that when they were thrown into the fire, the guys that threw them in were burned up. Now that's hot. Now there are a bunch of little things that don't really hold together in the story because somehow wherever the king is looking on from, he can see what's in the fire and he's not burning up. So I don't quite understand exactly the logistics of the whole story. But anyway, the people are thrown in the fire, and the people who threw them in are thrown back, and the king says, "What's going on here? Didn't we just throw three people in the fire? It seems there's a fourth." And yes, there was an angel dancing with them. Diana, did you see the song? I saw you when the song a little bit ago had that music that was moving a little bit. I saw you dancing with your bear back there. A fox, okay. At any rate, yes, how insulting to the bear. I'm so sorry. But anyway, here what happens, but Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are Bendigo, bo, how do you pronounce Abednego? Nego. Nego, that's what I thought. Shadrach. Okay, so they are seen to be dancing there in the fire, and again they testify to the fact that it's not about us. Us being saved isn't about who we are. No, it's because our faithfulness to God. So we get to the next story, and it's about Daniel. This is up to chapter 4 now. And it's Daniel. And, as I said earlier, when they attacked Jerusalem, they sacked the place and they stole things, they took things, they appropriated things from the temple and the palace, So they took gold, they took wood carvings, they took stone carvings, they took all this back with them. So there were the people, but then there were the artifacts. And that's just a normal way that pillaging goes, right? Especially when it's led by the occupying force. So they came in and they took all this stuff. And then Balthazar throws a big party. And what happens in the party? He says, "Hey, we sacked Jerusalem. We brought back all this cool stuff. And it's sitting in a cupboard. We need to bring it out and get all the family here and eat and drink from all that great stuff we stole from Jerusalem." Right? So they get this big party going on, a lot of people, way bigger than Thanksgiving. And they have all this fine stuff. And what do? They're sitting down, they're eating and drinking. And all of a sudden, they see this hand writing on the wall. And of course, Balthazar is distressed and he needs an interpreter. Who can interpret what's going on here, what this writing is all about? And Daniel is recruited to come in, and he, of course, interprets, and then he is rewarded. And again, Balthazar recognizes the greatness of God. And he says, in verse 24, it says that, Balthazar, you've exalted yourself against the Lord of heaven. The vessels of his temple have been brought in before you. This is chapter 5, verse 24, 23, 24. You've praised the gods of silver and gold, of bronze, iron, wood, and stone, which do not see or hear or know, but the God in whose power is your very breath, and to whom belong all your ways, you have not honored. And so Balthazar receives the interpretation of this writing on the wall, and Daniel shares it with him. And rather than Daniel simply being killed or thrown in a fire or something like that, Daniel is given purple cloth. Daniel is exalted and honored because of his faithfulness, both to God and to Balthazar. But then that very night, he's killed, and Darius is put into power. And Darius now really likes what we didn't read, talks about how Daniel and Balthazar were close right from the start. And so Daniel was one of the local administrators. And he had a number of satraps that would report to him about the activities in the area. So it was a fairly strict hierarchy that was over a vast, vast area. And all of these local, for lack of a better term, I'd say local government authorities who are there with their informants, right? So you've got each one of those satraps who has an informant who's giving information back to the regional administrator. So it's a strict, clear hierarchy. And these three people then are the ones who report to Darius. And they very quickly consolidate these administrators, quickly decide, you know, Daniel's no good. He's getting too much privilege. He's getting too much of Darius's attention. So we need to intervene. And so what do? They already know that Daniel is faithful to this other God, the God of Israel, the God of the Hebrew people. They know that. And so they observe and they realize, yes, he's saying his prayers, just like Shadrach, Meshach. It's a repeat of the same thing. And so they make a law. Can't worship anybody else. And it's interesting. No God, no person. So, you know, in the story before with Balthazar, they're accused of worshiping objects. You know, so it's a repeat of the golden calf and that kind of thing. You know, allegiance to things, material, formed by people's hands. So it's idol worship. And what happens here is that they come before Darius and say, you know, didn't you just make a law? Interdict, it's called an interdict in this particular, my translation. What's interdict mean? Well, if you break the word down within, yeah, interdict. So, yeah, dict is a statement, diction, dictum. There are a whole bunch of words that go back to that same origin. So it's an internal law that's been formed and it's being imposed on all these people. And in the case now of Daniel here, he's going to be, if he's been caught in worship, worshiping his God, and Darius knows it and has accepted that really because he loves Daniel. But then when they come and they make this accusation and they say, this very thing that man that you love is doing goes against the law that you signed and that can never be changed. Interesting. I won't make direct application to current realities, but that's how things go. Law is law until it affects somebody that the king favors. You know, and then we find ways to work around it. But in this particular case, he says, I'm caught here. I have to follow the law. I have to throw him in the lion's den. And I have to have all these people seal that rock in place around the lions with my signet ring and their signet ring so that, what? It can't be opened. It can't be moved. Otherwise, it would be visible, right? So he goes and he fasts and he prays all night and he doesn't know, you know, to whom he's praying or what exactly, but he does. And the next morning, after a sleepless night, he goes there and he says, Daniel, please, I hope you're still alive. Are you in there? Do you hear me? And Daniel says, yes. The rock's removed. And then what's his response? It's a terrible, wicked response. Darius's response is to save Daniel. And then he throws in all his administrators, wives, children, etc., dumps them all. And before they hit the ground, they're being maimed. So it's a level of wickedness that's hard to imagine. And last week, remember, with Lydia, who was saved? Whole of her household. With this situation, who's guilty? The whole household. In an age of individualism, we can't imagine that. I'm not guilty, it was Ernie. Oh no, I mean, it was Chris. We very, very quickly shift the blame to somebody else, right? Now, we don't see ourselves in that close a relationship, even with our families. So anyway, the net result, though, is what's important. And I haven't done it, but up until this time, there are at least three times where the kings are confessing God's greatness, the God of Israel's greatness. And now this is the third one. It says, God, the king then, King Darius, who wrote to all peoples and nations of every language throughout the whole world, may you have abundant prosperity. I make a decree that in all my royal dominion, people shall tremble and fear before the God of Daniel. For he, that God of Daniel, is the living God enduring forever. His kingdom shall never be destroyed, and his dominion has no end. He delivers and rescues. He works signs and wonders in heaven and on earth, and he has saved Daniel from the power of the lions. So this Daniel prospered during the reign of Darius and the reign of Cyrus the Persian. Now, what does the language there of Darius remind you of? What does it remind you of? And the earth shall be. I've got the words right, but the sound, the lyrics or the melody or whatever. You know, what about Revelation? What about the vision of peace, of shalom? You know, that it includes all peoples, all languages. He makes this edict for the whole world. It's not exclusive. It's radically inclusive. Because it's all people and all languages being called to faithfulness to this God. So it's a several thousand years before precursor, well, hundreds of years before, precursor to what we see in Revelation. where all tribes and nations shall gather around the throne of God and so forth. So anyway, in Daniel, what we see is how faithfulness to this God, to the God of Israel, was a testimony to the nations. It's not an imposition on the nations. It's simply a testimony to the nations. So in this particular story, this set of stories, it's a witness to how do we act? And that's where it got this title, Between a Rock and a Hard Place, because they're thinking about Daniel. But then it gets to Jesus here in the Luke 23 passage, and I'll wrap this up quickly here. It says, then the assembly rose as a body and brought Jesus before Pilate. They began to accuse him. So you've got these different retractors going after Jesus. And, you know, they're trying to tear him down. They take him before the Pilate, who is both a religious and a political authority. And they bring Jesus before Pilate. Then they began to accuse him, saying, we found this man inciting our nation, forbidding us to pay taxes to Caesar, and saying that he himself is the Messiah, a king. So let's break that down a little bit. So Pilate is who? You know, the taxes are being paid to Caesar. So Pilate's not Caesar, right? Where is Pilate or Caesar? Rome. Caesar's in Rome. Where is Pilate? Jerusalem. So in terms of equivalency here in relationship, where would Jesus be in relationship, say, to Daniel? Pilate, I should say Pilate, not Jesus. Pilate is the equivalent of a local government authority, like I said earlier. Yeah. So Pilate, it's not that he is the chief administrator, but he is a local person from the area. So it's you know, it's typical divide and rule kind of structure. So you get local people to enforce the law. That saves you having all the trouble of learning the language, doing all the dirty work. You've got these people locally who can exploit the networks and so forth and impose rule. So Pilate is in a tricky position because on the one hand, he's got all these relationships and understands his people. On the other hand, who does he represent? But Caesar. So he's stuck too between a rock and a hard place. And Jesus then is between a rock and a hard place. Why? Because here he's got these accusers who have brought him in and are saying things that Jesus has said. With nuances, right? Because, you know, with the taxation question, he said, got the fish, took it out and said, you know, whose face is on this coin and so on and so forth. And so, okay, it has the king's face. Give to Caesar what belongs to Caesar, you know. So he really doesn't say, don't pay your taxes. But he also says your loyalty is not supposed to be to Caesar. So he's questioning the structure of society and how it's lived out and what it means. And then he says, Pilate says, are you actually the king like they've said, the king of the Jews? Now, in some of the tellings of this story, He says, Jesus' response is, "You have said it." But in this telling of the story, he says it slightly differently. He says, "You say so." So there's less direct of a confessional element in this reading, in a sense, because Jesus says, "You say so." Pilate doesn't say, "Hold it, don't manipulate my words." Pilate says, "I find no basis for an accusation against this man." So he doesn't enter into a debate about Jesus's actual authority or power or position. He sidesteps that. He says, "Look, I don't want it on my hands. Whatever happens here, it's not about it's I'm not going to mix in this whole affair." So he steps back from his hard place, as it were. And though the crowd, though, was insistent and said, "He stirs up the people by teaching throughout all Judea, from Galilee, where he began, even to this very place here in Jerusalem." He's been spreading this negative propaganda that goes against the colonizing authorities, right? So they're taking it to the correct place by taking it to Pilate and making it about politics, not about faith, right? But Pilate sidesteps the whole thing. So what is the point about all of this? First of all, I say that I rejected this "Between a Rock and a Hard Place" as a title, but I didn't communicate that very well to Pat, so it came out as the title. And so I feel like that's God's work, because it forced me to keep knocking on that piece. And I wanted to say that growth takes place in the cracks. I don't know if any of you are Leonard Cohen fans, but now I can't think of the title of the song nor most of the words. But what he says is he looks at the cracks and he says, "It's the cracks where the light gets in." And I really like that phrase, that when we make these solid things, when there are no quiet cracks, there's no light. And where there's light, what is there? What? Growth. Growth comes where there are cracks between. So when you're in a rock and a hard place, is there no hope? No, it's not that there's no hope. Growth comes in that crack. And the question is, where will you place your faith? Where will you place your loyalty? Will it be to take sides in the crack, or will it be to rest faithful to what God has called you to be and to do? And over and over and over again in Daniel, we see that the byproduct of remaining faithful is being a testimony to the powers. So as we think about how we respond over these next years and months and decades to in our relationship with the powers, our response is to be based on faithfulness to God. And yes, there's truth in different ways about authority, political authority, and so forth, and that God's active in those processes. But the thing is, Whether we like the person or we don't like the person, we say the same thing, right? You know? So if we say Trump is the person that God chose, then Biden was the person that God chose 4 years ago. You know? It's the same logic that no matter who the ruler is, we respect the fact that God has placed them there. That's just part of that logic. And Daniel's story holds true because it's not that he's faithful to God because these authorities have been good to him. It's they've been good to him because he confronted them with his faithfulness to God. And so that's where we are. How do we be faithful to the broader truth of God and our testimony within this context? No matter what side you're on. So let's pray. Lord God of grace and mercy, we enter this Advent season with many thoughts.